Hello, dear internet strangers. Today is Saturday, July 31st, and we are talking in obscurity. I am Kevin Carlson, and this is
Steve Kubitz.
And we are talking about Leviathan Wakes by James S.A. Corey. It's a space opera science fiction book.
Feels really good to be having a book that isn't an L related to a virus. You know, people don't get sick. It's just nice to have a nice simple book where everything starts. The crux of it is 600 pages, but really it's 500 pages of everything going according to plan, 100 of just a backlog of how great everything went.
Yep, nobody gets sick, nobody dies, everybody has a good time.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, like, I feel like we've covered pandemic stuff, and, you know, it's nice to have a book that isn't all, like...
We're going
to
move on.
Doesn't remind me of the last 16 months of our life at
all. Moving on here and talking in obscurity. We're not going to be mired in the past.
No, we're done. This is a future book. Everything's set in the future.
All right, well, let's get into what we love about the book.
Hell yeah.
And, like, I'm a simple creature, and I like any book with big spaceship battles, there's political intrigues, sort of like Game of Thrones. Oh, and there's a giant bioweapon, and everybody gets sick and gets horribly dies.
Son of a...
But, like, it's done interesting-wise. I mean, people become, like, these... Well, they get vomity, and it's like a real bad flu.
But I would argue, though, that, you know... Like, the space flu kills more than this virus.
Yeah.
Every year.
Yeah. Except it doesn't. And I'll get past the bioweapon part here. I really like the two protagonists of this. They're really only two point of view characters, Captain James Holden and Detective Miller. And I like how Holden is really the idealist of the group, and he's played off by Miller, who's more... he's more pragmatic, and he's more, the ends justify the means, and he's just a guy out to do what he thinks needs to be done.
Yeah, I actually, in a similar way, I love the two leads. I really do. And, you know, I'm a sucker for an idealistic character. That's I'm an idealistic person in my personal life. And then, but also at the same time, I really like how there are two people that, it's so easy to write a story where, oh, okay, this person is an idealist, this person's realistic, is a realist. And everything has to go, everything has to fit sort of that frame of how they are as people. These two are very obviously people.
Yeah.
They have flaws, they don't always act in quote-unquote character.
Yeah, I like those moments a lot in this, is that that's a hard thing to hit with characters, is that sometimes people don't act always according to their nature.
Yeah, I think that there's something to be said about, sometimes as a person you can believe wholeheartedly this is how you view the world. Whether it's, I view the world in the optimist. I believe that, you know, people are inherently good, or, you know, I'm a cynic. I believe that people are inherently self-serving and will always screw you over if given opportunity. However, often in life, sometimes idealists think people suck. Sometimes, you know, these cynical characters can have moments of hope and sort of longing that doesn't fit that sort of cynical worldview. And I think this book does a great job with the two leads. Of making them sort of be a little balanced. And it's not just they're balanced in situations that fit it. There are situations that they're kind of just reacting to what's going on in the story. And I think there's something to be said about you can just react. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're lying or you're not, you know, your nature is, you know, this is what your real nature is. Sometimes you're just reactive. And that's okay. And I think these characters both, especially Detective Miller, not to spoil anything, they have moments where they're almost like they crisscross who's the idealist and who's they crisscross a lot.
I do feel that Miller grows a little bit more than Holden in this, and that's partly because of age. Holden's a young guy, and Miller's firmly middle-aged. The thing that I want to talk about next is I really like the practical details of life in space, because it's interesting how James S.A. Corey... describes the physiology of people who live in space in microgravity, in low gravity situations, because after generations of that, you would expect people to look different. And I like how the Belters are all described as being very tall, and they have like big heads, and people from Earth, or Earthers as they're called, tend to be shorter and stockier and more muscular, and people from Mars are somewhere in between those two extremes. And I like the... how after generations of time, how people start to look different. And that really breeds into the whole political intrigue part of this, because people start changing their language and how they speak, and they look different. And, well, people, we don't do well with other people who look different from each other. Like, there's a whole long history, and actual history, where we don't like each other just because we look different.
Yeah, and I think that to jump on that a little bit, the thing I really like about this book, and I would argue is my sort of first thing, is the world that's built in this sort of, when I say the world, I don't mean a planet, I mean the whole overarching world of the book, is really, it feels large. Mm-hmm. And it feels multifaceted. It doesn't feel like it's a simple, like, here's the character from Earth, they're clearly the best because we live on Earth. Mm-hmm. And here's a character from Mars, and they're bad, and these people, every sort of thing, every person you meet, whether they're Belters or people from Earth, people from Mars, or, the other ship, SS, there's good and bad, and sort of in every, there's sort of areas of gray in all of them. And I think that because of that, the world feels really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's no boring, like, sometimes with space stories, you can run the risk of making the world, even though it's large, feel really small, because you're only focusing on sort of,
the characters become stereotyped.
Yeah, and I think this story, especially I'd say the first third of it, does a really good job of just showing you these people and all their different perspectives, and everyone you meet feels like a person that you sort of want to meet.
Yeah, and I think a lot what helps with that a lot is that the writing is actually kind of funny at times, and there's a lot of like humor that comes across in it that you don't normally associate hard science fiction with funny or humorous, but there are some times where I was just howling at things that a character said, or the timing of a moment, or it's baked in right into the writing. I think it's pretty funny.
Yeah, I think that, for me, like, I'm not often the biggest fan of hard science fiction. It's not my wheelhouse of what books I usually read. But what I really enjoyed about this is that there were moments of brevity. And there's a lot of things in this book that are not that.
And we're really dark.
There's some really dark and especially very descriptively dark moments. Not going to get into sort of recapping it. That's your territory. But the fact that this the same book that can make me go, oh, that's like literally out loud, because I listen to those on Audible, and my wife will then go, what's wrong? I'm like, I don't want to get into it. But the same book then can also make me crack up laughing.
The bit with the hands.
Yeah, like it's amazing that a book that can make me literally cringe, and sort of that visceral, where, because your mind's always going to fill in gaps way worse than any story can really do to you.
Yeah.
But they can make me laugh. That's a pretty impressive feat of writing, and I think that a lot of stories struggle with that, because I think it's sometimes it's. Marvel, I think, is, and not to get too off topic, Marvel's the best at that, where they can have a universe that's really funny, but then also really dark. Mm-hmm. And I think you'll see the example of would be like DC movies sometimes struggling with that, or DC's comedy in a lot of their bigger movies that weren't success.
It feels forced. It
feels really forced.
Well, speaking of that, let's get into what we don't love about this. And I don't have a whole lot that I don't love, so I'm going to go real petty. Mm-hmm. My first petty complaint is the cover art. It's part of the book. It's valid. And I feel bad, because some artists work really hard on these covers, and I hate all of them. I hate all of them in different degrees, because, like, I never know what the fuck is going on. Like, Leviathan Wakes probably has the best cover art, because there's the ship that's probably the Canterbury, because there's a giant thing of ice, maybe, and, like, but you can't see the full thing, and it just annoys the shit out of me.
See, if we're gonna do dislikes, see, mine's less petty. Which is fine. Obviously I got into a little bit with that, hard sci-fi is not my wheelhouse, but other than that, I actually find that this story, so there's a lot of stuff going on, especially in the first chunk of the book, and it's this real, like, once the, you spend most of the book thinking it's a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whodunit, so to speak, and then once the greater threat is revealed, it really feels like it takes forever to actually pay it off.
Yeah.
You get the reveal, and you're like, oh, okay, this is what this actually is.
And then we get back into the mysterious.
Then we get back to the mystery. But the thing is, you already know the mystery, because you already have the bigger reveal, you know the mystery doesn't mean that much anymore.
Yeah, it's the, when are we going to deal with a big, bad threat?
Yeah.
We all saw what happened. Like, how are we all not, like, going insane about that.
Yeah, and I think that, like, one of my biggest pet peeves in any story is when there's an obvious world-ending threat, and there's a villain who's, like, not, they're not trying to help the world-ending threat. They're just trying to be evil, you know, they're doing their evil thing. And they don't look at that and go, oh, okay, I need to stop doing this, otherwise I'm not going to have any world to be evil on. And I feel like this story has a main character, an evil sort of villain, main character, an evil villain like that. That's like, what are you doing?
Clearly, this is out of control.
Like, something's amiss here, and you, like, clearly need to, like, take a beat and, like, realize that, okay, like, Helmet, even when Darkseid showed up, Lex Luthor was like, okay, I gotta let Superman, I know we've been feuding for a while, but let's
deal with this.
Let's deal with this, because this is clearly a bigger threat than anything else going on right now. And I feel like some of the villain, the main villain in the story, to me feels like a little, I don't want to say cartoony, but just like, dude, really? Still? Even with, like, everything going on around you, you still gotta be, like, a little mustache twirler?
Well, that's all very well thought out. And those are great points, and I'm gonna bring it back to not-so-great points, and back to the petty level of, like, I don't like how the ships are designed. Like, I was raised on Star Trek and Star Wars, and everything is, like, cool, shark-like, aerodynamic things, and, like, it's a great explanation for hard science fiction description. You can make an argument for an aerodynamically shaped ship that's going close to the speed of light because of various reasons. I'm not going to get into for time's sake. But, like, yeah, moving at the speed these ships are moving around the solar system, fast from a human scale, but not, like, anywhere near the speed of light, you don't really need to make a ship by aerodynamic because there's no air to go through. So the ships are described as, like, the Rocinante is described as being a wedge, and other ships are sort of described as being, like, a tower. And, like, it's maximum petty of me, but, like, I just don't like the idea that the ships look exactly what the cover art is trying to depict to me, and I again, don't like that cover art.
Interestingly enough, my least favorite kind of spaceship is the same as my least favorite kind of French fry, a wedge. So, like, I actually completely agree with you. And I know we don't usually like to hammer the same point.
Yeah.
But I'm going to hammer the same point here a little bit.
Yeah, do it.
That I do find some of the way the descriptors of the ships very, like, okay, we get it.
It's little, like, yeah, it's a box.
It doesn't make it seem like, you know, whenever you, I don't know if you do this, whenever I read any, like, whether it's hard sci-fi, space opera sci-fi, like Star Wars.
Yeah.
I end up inevitably thinking, man, what would my life be like if I existed a couple hundred years in the future where, like, this might be a more realistic thing for me to do. And nowhere am I ever thinking, man, I really wish I could ride on, like, a really ugly-looking spaceship that's really boring and monotonous.
I'm never that cowboy riding in the fucking box.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, now back to something that isn't hammering your same point, I actually find that as a standalone story, now, this is obviously part of a series, so if you're a person that, you know, if you're reading this, you know, it's kind of like if you're watching a bunch of movies in a row, that, you know, like the Godfather series.
Yeah.
You can watch 1 through 3 and they hammer different things home and they hammer different things that they get. So that, you know, it does sort of feel like one overall narrative. But for this, as it's part of a series, this standalone story, it just feels like sometimes that it's just setting up the next story.
Yeah, it does.
And I feel like as a pure standalone, I think at times it feels like it's just uninterested in telling a cohesive single story because it knows
there's going to be more.
There's more to come.
And there's a lot more of them, too. Because they definitely go to places that, well, this will be important later, and this person here, he'll be important later. But why don't we move on into the spoiler section of this? We're at about halfway here, and this is your time. We're really belaboring this point. The spoilers are going to start. I'm going to start reading the synopsis that we have prepared for you, then we're gonna go back and forth and analyze the story for you.
And I'm gonna say this, if you complain about spoilers after this, I will come to your house and I will move something away without you realizing it. You're gonna be really annoyed because you're gonna think, oh my god, where's my favorite cereal spoon?
Why is it 6 feet to the left? Yeah,
that's gonna be me. I'm petty like that.
A lot of pettiness in this issue.
Yeah.
Alright, so the quick and dirty synopsis is, the story starts with a woman named Julie Mao, whose ship had been attacked. She and the rest of her crew were taken prisoner, but only she was stuffed into a closet for days. Eventually, she escapes and goes looking for anyone else on the ship, but everything is eerily quiet and the ship seems to be abandoned, until she reaches engineering, where there appears to be some fleshy thing growing out of the core of the engine. Then, when the fleshy object moves, she spots a head and realizes that whatever it is, it used to be human. Then we jump into the next chapter where we meet James Holden, XO of the Canterbury, an old giant ice-hauling spaceship. The crew of the Canterbury detects a distress signal, and Holden leads a small group from the Canterbury over to the distress ship via a shuttle, where they quickly discovered that the derelict had been left as a trap. The Canterbury is destroyed, leaving Holden in charge of the four survivors from the Canterbury on a shuttle designed to not go far. This doesn't stop him from broadcasting what he found on the derelict ship, which he deduces was used as bait. The transmitter of the distress signal seems to have come from Mars. With the destruction of the Canterbury, and James Holden's apparently pointing the finger at Mars, the whole solar system braces for possible war. Then we meet the second perspective character of this novel, Miller, a cop on Ceres Station. Miller is aggressively focused on the small picture of life, specifically his life as a cop on Ceres in the belt, as in the asteroid belt where Ceres Station is located. Miller is tasked with finding a missing rich girl and shipping her back off to Earth. Her name is Julie Mao. Through their trials of surviving with everyone in the solar system seeming out to kill them, Holden and crew obtain a small, swanky new warship of their own. They are given a lead to go to Eros Station and make contact with a member of the Outer Planets Alliance, who they believe is the sole survivor of the derelict ship that they found at the beginning of the story, and who might know who really killed the Canterbury. On Eros Station, Holden and Miller meet up for the first time and find the disfigured body of Julie Mao. A biological weapon had killed her. At this point that Miller realizes that the cops on Eros Station are actually criminals from Ceres Station. They had been hired by an evil corporation to set up an experiment using Julie Mao's body, and the entire population of Eros Station are going to be their guinea pigs. The biological weapon makes people into vomit zombies, way worse than the traditional bitey kind. Eventually, they mutate into even more grotesque abominations. Miller and Holden and Holden's crew barely escape Eros with their lives and go after the evil corporation that released the bioweapon. After the attack, they meet up with the head sociopathic scientist who pleads their murderous case, revealing that the bioweapon that they were studying wasn't something they created, but something that they had found, as in it's extraterrestrial. Miller shoots him in the head several times anyway. In the end, there is still Eros Station to contend with, as the abominations within it don't just die off, they combine, becoming one big life form. A desperate plan is formed to knock Eros Station into a course where it will eventually fall into the sun by ramming it with a large spaceship. But unfortunately, it dodges and then heads for Earth. With everyone shitting their collective pants after the revelation that an asteroid just came alive and is self-aware, Miller makes his way back into Eros Station, alone. He's confronted by a grotesque menagerie of repurposed biology, but ultimately realizes that Julie, in some way, is still alive. He finds her and wakes her up. She had been dreaming she was on her old racing ship and wanted to go home, to Earth. Miller convinces her that they can't go there, and compromises with her to go to Venus instead, and she agrees. She asks him what will happen next, and he admits that he doesn't know, but he takes off his suit and tells her whatever it is, they'll face it together. And that's the story.
I gotta say, you know, I never read this book.
That's new, great news to find out halfway through.
So I mean, wow! I can't believe all that happened. I mean, I just seriously, the stuff that really like hits me about this is we talk about sort of Detective Miller's character growth at the end there. You know, I love that. I love this character who spends 90% of the book as this sort of gruff, noir-esque detective. You know, just a cynical dude. Of all the offices and all the planets and all the solar system, why does she have to walk into mine? You know, but he becomes this sort of hopeful that, you know, I don't want this to end badly. I can't let it end badly. So I'm going to do the thing. I'm going to try to plead to this grotesque sort of husk of a person.
He feels that he can reach her at the end. And, like, I think that's the biggest idealistic turn for him, and that's what I mean by, like, I think he grows the most, because if he was just a pure pragmatist, he would never have gone into Eros Station, and he wouldn't have thought that he could reach Julie, because they came up with a plan B of just, let's throw all the nukes at it, which is really our plan for everything.
That's every movie or book with aliens or any kind of threat. The thing is always, have we tried nuking it out of the sky?
Yeah, and it, like, never works.
Once I want to see a story where that's literally all it takes and that's it.
We nuked it, and that was it.
And that was it.
That worked.
And then they immediately, like the last scene of the movie is the aliens. We didn't know that there's powerful weaponry. Oh my god, we didn't plan this at all.
Yeah, you get Morgan Freeman to do a narration about, like, and then the aliens were destroyed because they had never, like, discovered the atomic bomb.
Yeah, like, I'd love that. I think I would love to see a story that ends that way. Like, when I write my first ever sci-fi story, that's how it's going to end.
Spoilers. We nuked it. We won.
And it worked. It was seriously, like, it could not have been, like, yeah, we saved the Earth because we just had nukes.
And trying to communicate with them was a huge waste of time.
Yeah, huge waste of time. Just the moment you see anyone that looks different than you that's from the sky, you bomb them.
Well, we're joking there, but, like, I feel like this novel really is, it's very focused on human nature, and it's... I think it's very realistic to me, and it feels realistic to me, because even whenever we move out into space and we're colonizing all the different planets and dwarf planets of our solar system, we're still the same intrinsic assholes we've always been. We're always territorial. That person speaks a little different, looks a little different. I hate them. And while depressing, I find to be very authentic, that, like, people form tribes, and they form in-groups and out-groups. And if you're in the out-group, you're dangerous, and that's just how human nature, and, like, hopefully one day we transcend that, but clearly not at this point in history.
Yeah, and I think that for me, like, you know, we talk about the book does a lot of realism versus idealism and what's more effective, what's the effective way to be,
mm-hmm.
what, you know, whether it's on your home planet, like, you know, the real world, or in this fictional universe where we've colonized a bunch of, you know, planets. And I think that, like, you know, for me, as speaking as a very hopeful optimist, which is, like, kind of a weird thing to be in this sort of our world, speaking as that, I find that this book does a great job, and it's probably the thing, I know we already did likes and dislikes, but the thing I like most is that a character that you can be an idealistic person, and you can be hopeful, and not be a complete fucking moron.
Yeah, and I like how there is that dichotomy of idealism versus pragmatism. But I like that they both get to be right at different times.
Yeah, that's because it's really boring. I think often characters, you know, we talked about it earlier, sort of Detective Miller is this sort of gruff, noir-esque character where his entire sort of thing is very much a classic. If anyone's familiar with film noir, you know this type. The overweight, not necessarily overweight, but sort of the out-of-shape, gruff detective whose glory days are a little bit behind him. But now he's got to get kind of dragged back into duty, and, you know, because of this mystery he has to solve. And basically the thing is the mystery. But as the mystery unwinds and gets revealed, the whole world goes to hell.
Yeah.
And I think that he is a really cool... It's a space noir without being a space noir.
Well, I think it's a lot of things. I mean, it's a horror story. It's a space opera. It's a big political intrigue. And I would argue that it's a mystery noir-style story, especially within Miller chapters. But speaking of Miller, like, I found he's a very romantic character. And I love the scene with him convincing Julie to basically not destroy Earth. And there's a show, by the way, called The Expanse. And how they do that in the show, it's one of my favorite scenes in the show. I don't want to, like, go too far into the show aspect of this or spoil that, but, like, all of that aside, how pretty that is and how romantic he can be, it's a little bit creepy when you consider the fact that he is firmly upper middle age and he up and left his entire life and basically tanked his career because he decided that he was in love with a much younger woman who he has never met. And the whole book, until, like, the final chapters, is... He doesn't meet her until, like, the very end. And he has whole conversations with her in his head, and he hallucinates seeing her, and she talks to him, and he realizes, like, halfway through that he is in love with this woman that he's supposed to find and send back to Earth, which he fails at because he convinces her to go to Venus. But that's all a little... Yeah.
I think for me, like, you know, what... You want, when you have a character that is sort of your main lead, you want to think of them in a positive light because they're your protagonist, and mm-hmm. he's one of the protagonists of the story. But the logic side of your brain that knows inherently that we all know the creepy old dude that hits on the 20-something girl.
Yeah.
We've met that person. We've seen them. You know, we've seen them around. so you instinctively find a level of just like, ugh, like with how much he projects onto this woman who I think is in her early 20s, if I remember correctly. Like
she's a young heiress of a billionaire.
Yeah, I mean, she's not, and it's not like she's an old 20. You know what I mean? Like, you know that sort of trope that like that, oh, she, you know, she's an old soul, and so it makes sense that she's in love with, no. And the thing is, it's entirely projected from Miller to her. You don't, there's no even chance to even like placate feelings because he only meets her once.
Yeah, and I think she takes it well. She was, you know, a horrible giant space monster at the time, but like, you know, she takes their last meeting very well. And they have a bit of a hug. I think that's in the book.
They have a little moment.
Yeah, they have a moment.
And I think that, and overall, I think that, you know, for me, as a reader of I don't have a lot of experience with this series, so I don't really have, you have more context than I do. Mm. So all I have is this book so far. So when I see all this stuff happening, it feels super just off-putting. And because you start realizing like more and more as the story sort of, you know, sort of gets revealed and things get kind of, the thread gets pulled a little bit. It reminds me in a weird way of the Joker movie, where the romantic thing between Joker and I can't remember his girlfriend's name is all in his head.
Yeah.
And so then all the stuff that feels kind of off-putting, you realize, oh, it is off-putting. This dude's fucking crazy. And I think Miller's a little bit, not the same vein. He's not Joker, but that it feels a little like, oh, okay, this, a lot of this, he's projecting this. It's not that he's in love with this woman. He's in love with the idea of this woman.
I think that's because he's a sad, lonely guy at the end of his career, and there's a sad moment whenever it's revealed to him that he may have been, that his co-workers may have considered him great back in the day, but like he's the joke of the station. That's why he gets the partner that nobody wants, and everybody regards him as a has-been, and he was unaware of that. And then towards the end of his career, it comes crashing down on him that he was a has-been. And I also like that, to play devil's advocate against my point of like tearing down Miller and tearing down this character, I like that another character that we didn't mention in the synopsis, his name's Fred Johnson, he's a big Outer Planets guy, points out that Miller isn't a hero. He was a pain in the ass, but he was just a guy trying his best. And he was a deeply flawed man, but he was always doing what he thought was for the best. And that was good enough to save Earth. So, like, at the end of the day, he did do something heroic with all of this.
And I think it's important to also remember that what this story does well is that we're, everyone, whether they're Holden, who's this sort of, like, very clean-cut, very, like, Captain America-esque kind of person, very, you know, just straight-laced, or, you know, the detective character, who's a little gruff, who's a little tough, rough around the edges, but you can have moments of being truly heroic and truly doing the right thing when it matters most. And I think it's great that both people, both characters, the idealist and the realist, both have complete moments where they are completely justified, completely heroic, and they absolutely nail it.
Yeah, and I think that plays well into what I want to talk about in my parting thoughts for this book, is that I used to not like characters like James Holden, because he kind of seemed like Superman and Captain America. Why I didn't like them when I was younger is because it just seemed like the square-jawed hero type. And as time has gone on, I've come to appreciate that character type more. Because if everybody's the cynical Batman type, and everybody sucks and everything sucks, then everybody sounds the same, and it's kind of boring. And like, you really need your James Holdens to like inject optimism and add color and variety to the characters. Because at the end of the day, nobody really likes Miller a whole lot. Holden does, because he likes pretty much everybody. But nobody really likes Miller a whole lot. Even Holden kicks him off the ship. But everybody, even whenever they disagree with him, even whenever they're trying to kill him, everybody seems to like Holden, to at least a degree. It was like, yeah, they might find him to be an overly honest, pompous pain in the ass, but everybody always comes around on Holden. And like, I came around on him. I think that he's ultimately the most charming character of this series. And I don't want to spoil too much for him.
Yeah, and you know, for me, as you know, I love a straight-laced, does-the-right-thing character. That's my favorite hero of all time is Superman. Like, yeah. And that's my favorite hero, period. I don't care whether it's comic books or whatever. Like, my favorite fictional character ever is Superman. And people kind of rag on me about that. Like, oh, he's so boring. And I'm like, then you've never read a good Superman story. And I think in this case, he's not a super, you know, Holden's not a Superman by any means. Mm-hmm. But he's a proof that you can have a character that is just, I would say, aggressively, annoyingly so, always tries to do the right thing, and annoyingly believes in people, and just is core decent.
Yeah, and before we go, last thought, and we were talking about this in our pre-note session. Holden ultimately ended up becoming an ice hauler because he was part of the Earth Navy, and he was given an order to fire on these unarmed belters, and he refused to do it because he wouldn't become a murderer because he felt it was wrong. Whereas another character, Fred Johnson, who I mentioned briefly, who's now the leader of the OPA, he used to be part of the Earth Navy, and he is known as the Butcher of Anderson Station. But the thing is, he had to become the Butcher of Anderson Station, where he killed all those people. He let them make him into a murderer before he changed sides and he realized what was wrong. I think that's why Holden's a better man than Fred.
And Holden, to me, is an example of you. When you're a person that at your core is faced with the toughest decision imaginable, you're a military man in this case. Your entire life is sort of this war. And you're faced with the decision of your duty and what you know is right. And I think it's fascinating that, you know, Holden as a character did what was right. And, you know, sort of with the Fred Johnson character doing the wrong thing, even though he technically did, he did the wrong thing for the quote-unquote right reasons because he was doing his duty. But sometimes the part of your, sort of the thing you have to do in your life, and that's whether it's in the story or in real life, sometimes you have to do the wrong thing in terms of what your job title is because you know it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I think this book really hammers that home in a really nice way.
Yeah. Well, that's our thoughts on Leviathan Wakes. I hope you enjoyed our talk today, and we'll see you next month.